At the age of 21, Daniela Moroz has already fitted in a lifetime's worth of winning. The kiteboarder has won 5 world championships and 4 European championships. She's a 3-time winner of US Sailing's Rolex Yachtswoman of the Year, and she races with Jimmy Spithill's USA team on the Sail GP circuit. So, Daniela, I want to welcome you onto the call. Great to have you on. Where are you today?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. I'm in Marseille right now in France.
Amazing. So that is the Olympic venue. Obviously, that's where you're aiming your professional career right now. So is that the reason for landing in Marseille?
Kind of. I'm going to be doing the Hier Regatta in a couple weeks, the French Olympic week. And I think it's at the end of this month. So I was kind of in between regattas. I just finished up the Palma Regatta and I had a couple weeks in between. So, and I've just been going nonstop the last quite a bit. So I was like, I need to take a little holiday and just slow down and sleep and chill for a little bit. So I just got a hotel in Marseille and I'm taking it easy for a couple of days. And then I get to here in a few days and I'll start training there for the Hier Regatta.
Right. Well, it looks like you've made a nice choice of hotel in Marseille. It looks amazing. Well done on that choice. And well done for the Princess Sofia Trophy last week, where I got to meet you in person. And when I saw you, you weren't quite winning the regatta, but you came good on the final day and you did actually win the kite foiling at the Princess Sofia Trophy. So just tell us about your week last week and what it was like for kite foiling finally to be part of the Olympic scene.
Yeah, honestly, it was a pretty interesting week for me because I haven't lost a regatta since 2016. So this was the first time that I wasn't leading the entire thing. So it was a pretty just different position for me to be in. And it was a really good learning experience. Like I just learned so much from it. And I think that there's a few different reasons that I just wasn't on top of it from the start. But I think the fact that I was able to come back in the second half of the regatta and really pull it together in the final and just keep grinding away and keep trying to get better every race, I think that I was just really, really proud of that and proud of the way I was able to pull it together and just come back at the end. So I think that win was honestly almost more satisfying than any of the worlds I've won just because it was just like extra hard and the margins are getting smaller and the fleet is just improving so much, which is awesome. So it's just super exciting times. And of course it was our first proper event kind of with the rest of the Olympic sailing classes. So that was really cool just to be amongst all the other Olympic classes and to really be, I think, like recognized and kind of just on par with the rest of them. I think that was super cool.
Well, I really like to dig in more depth into how your week went and what your sort of mental approach was to the final day, having to attack from behind. Also want to remind you, well, Benny in the chat box has just reminded you, you're very welcome and we very much encourage you to ask questions and to come in with your questions directly to ask Daniela. And please indicate if you're not able to do that, if your microphone doesn't work or whatever, and I will ask those questions for you. Just to warm you up a bit, John Emmett, let's get you in because amazingly that we were both in Palma last week and we didn't get to see each other. So I just want to hear your perspective from the other end of the Bay of Palma, 6 kilometres away from where I was with the 49ers and the 470s in NACRA. So, John, how was the week for you?
Well, to be honest, I'm used to it. So I've done it both parks as a 49er campaign and never seeing the laser sailors. And as a laser sailor and never seeing the higher performance boats. But I never saw Daniela, but I probably cycled past twice a day on the bumpy, bumpy, bumpy bit. See, I can't actually turn my head very well after that. But I just thought it was absolutely amazing to be back at over 1,000 sailors. And I think I actually missed it like hell.
It was great to be back.
Yeah, first world problems, you know, not enough space in the boat park and sand everywhere. It was wonderful.
Well, John, we may well get you back in on the call a little bit later on. And if you've got any questions for Daniela or any comments to make, it'd be great to get you back in, John. But that goes for anybody here. And I can see that there are some fantastic sailors in this call, some of the medalists. But please, even if you are feeling like you've got a stupid question, you're not worthy of asking that question, pluck up the courage and ask it anyway, because there are no stupid questions. And sometimes the question that you are worried about asking is one that would never occur to me or to many other people, and it often reveals the most interesting answers. So please do pluck up the courage and ask those questions. Daniela, just give us a sense of, you're on an incredible win rate. You were in danger of losing that win rate last week, but you did manage to come back on the final day. How many regattas have you won on the trot, international competitions?
I'm not sure exactly the number, honestly, but last I checked, I was at around 25.
Right. And so when you were staring down the barrel of maybe not winning gold last week, how did that make you feel going into the final day?
I don't know. It was pretty interesting, honestly, because I always knew this day was coming in a way, and I always knew that it just wasn't realistic for me to keep winning everything all the time. And the fleet is just improving so much and the margins are getting so much smaller. So now if I make a mistake, it just is a lot more costly. I don't know. I was like, I don't want to say I was happy that it was happening, but I was definitely like, I was excited to kind of experience that and to be able to learn from that and to be put in that type of position. And it was like just such a good learning experience, like I said earlier. And I think I always struggled with just kind of handling pressure. And one thing that I've really been working on and that I've been wanting to practice is actually delivering a really good performance under pressure. So I was really kind of grateful almost just to have that experience and to be able to try to do that. Part of me was definitely a little bit, it was just weird because obviously I have been like winning for so long and I really don't know how to lose. It was just like a weird position for me to be in. But over the past year, I've really worked on having a process-oriented mindset and really keeping things in the big picture and just trying to, you know, focus on the small gains and the small percentages every single day. And so coming into this regatta, I was very specific about what I wanted to work on. And I honestly wasn't like really the best prepared for it just because I've been at school finishing up college and I've been just at CLGP and there's just been so much going on. So I literally coming into this regatta, like I just really wasn't prepared to deliver. But I think just being able to go through that whole experience and to be able to have the opportunity to come back, it was really cool, honestly. And I'm really glad that I got to learn from that.
If you're watching on Facebook, we're going to come off Facebook fairly shortly, but do come in on Zoom because this is open to all comers on Zoom and we've got another 50 minutes to go with Daniela. Daniela, you bought a copy of Road to Gold some months ago and you talked about being a process-oriented athlete just then. And I mean, you obviously got your campaigning worked out to a high degree already, but what were your reasons for getting Road to Gold? Where did you feel like you needed to fill in the gaps?
I think that I felt like I still feel like I know very little about campaigning and kind of what to even be doing in a way. So I think for me, the reason I wanted to get it was just to hear different perspectives and to hear the different stories and just learn from different people. So I love, I usually don't come onto the Q&A's live, but I always watch them. I watch the recordings later on. And it's really cool just to hear from the different athletes and all of their experiences, because I think everybody has some kind of wisdom or story that you can learn from. So I love talking to different people and whoever it is, even if they're not winning, whoever it is on the beach or in the boat park. I love hearing those stories because I think that there's just something to learn from everyone because they've been through different experiences than you have. So I think my reason for getting it was just to be able to hear all these different perspectives from different athletes from very different backgrounds, I think. And also I've really enjoyed doing the worksheets because I like to think I like to think about things, and I'm a really thoughtful person, and so the worksheets really help me think through things and actually, it forces you to really write down the answers and to think through all those questions and the concepts. So, those have been really helpful for me, and I've been enjoying those a lot.
Oh, well, that's very gratifying to hear, and thank you for that. And I'm wondering being a thoughtful person and the checklists and the worksheets helping you out, do you keep a notebook when you're racing, when you've had a day on the water? How much do you log things at the end of that?
Yeah, I log as much as I can. I take notes from every single session. Even if it's, even if it's something small, like what if it was just the conditions and what kite size I was on and what gear was working. I think any little bit helps, and I think also just being kind of recognizing patterns from all of that, and I think it just helps you kind of think through your session. And even if you didn't find anything super groundbreaking, I think it's just good to think through those things.
Great. Well, it's good to see some questions beginning to flow in. And let's throw to Augustine, who has a really good question. So, Augustine, let's see if we can get you in for this. See if I give you Augustine a little bit longer. Maybe not. Let's throw to Greg. Greg Rice, if you're there, and if we don't get Augustine in, I'll ask Augustine's question for him. But Greg, let's get you in. Hello, Greg. Oh, I don't see Greg on the list, actually. So I'm not doing very well here. In which case, I'm going to go down to John Emmett. Just to give us a sense of just how diverse your sailing is, Daniela. Where have you come from just now in Valencia, and also what else have you been up to? And then we'll get John in to ask his question. But just give us a sense of just how many different craft you've been sailing lately.
Yeah, so I primarily kite. I came from kiting. I didn't come from a sailing background. The first time I was on a sailboat was when I was 15 or 16, I think, and it was a Nacra 15. But since then, kiting has still been my priority. But along the way, I did a little bit of Nacra 17 sailing. I hopped on NFX a few times. I did a lot of WASP sailing over the past year, and then I also was selected to join the USCLGP team last year, which has been an incredible experience. And then I also just came from Valencia, actually, where I did some 69F sailing. So I've been definitely just getting more and more involved in more traditional sailing, which has been really cool. I'm learning a lot, and yeah, I pretty much take any opportunity I can get just to hop on a different boat or different craft, preferably foiling, but I'm open to others too.
Which leads nicely to John's question. So, John, fire away.
Well, I had two questions. The first very important one is, who are the two little people watching you, and do they follow you around a lot? Because it really interests me.
Yeah, so that's Simba and Buddy over there. Simba, they're my stuffed animals, and they travel with me everywhere.
Yeah, that's half the battle of campaigning. I know quite a few athletes who take a coffee machine or a pillow with them. But I asked this question to Glenn Ashby, and I think I stumbled over it, so I'll try and make it really short. But what do you find the fundamental difference between you, single person Olympic campaign, and the huge teams for Sail GP? How do you handle that? Because it's like from one spectrum to almost the opposite.
Yeah, very much. So I think the biggest difference is that in an Olympic campaign, and especially in the US, I think, where we just don't have that much funding, an Olympic campaign is all on you. Whereas at SailGP and more in pro sailing, There's a bit more of just like a structure in a way, and you're kind of being told what to do and guided a lot more. And you have an owner, let's say, that is in charge of, where you're going to be sailing and where you're training and all of that. Whereas an Olympic campaign, like, yes, you can choose where you go and what you do, but a lot of it is like it's still on you to be making the right decisions and to be figuring out the whole deal. So I'm doing everything from the funding to picking a coach to, flying to all these different places and choosing the regattas I'm doing and making sure I'm getting enough time on the water, but also enough sleep and, eating the right amount and all of that. So I think the biggest thing is just that in an Olympic campaign, it's all on you and you really have to be doing everything. And in Sail GP and stuff like that, I think it's more of just like a show up and do the job and then leave in a way.
John, any follow up on that? Good with that? I'm gonna move on. John seems to have frozen. Augustine is in a park, but let's see if we can get Augustine in to ask your question directly.
Hello? Hello,
Hi,
can you hear me?
Augustine. We
Hi.
can. Just tell us what do you sell? What's your personal interest?
So I'm into sailing WASP basically, but I also coach sailing in Canada. And yeah, I'm very and I've been getting into kite foiling just recreationally myself during the winters. And it's fantastic. So my question was mainly about what do you, Daniela, think that it's the three of the key technical aspects of your sailing that keep giving you that edge in terms of your competition? Because, kite foiling is fairly new in terms of Olympic sailing, and you clearly are the dominant competitor. So I'd like to hear what do you think are the three key things that you do that your competitors are not there yet, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think I'm still trying to figure a lot of that out in a way. But I think one of the big things is just pure boat speed. I think that I have at least a couple years on most of the other girls, so I think that I just have a little bit of better feel for the kite and how a kite should be flying and how a foil should feel under my feet. So I think that's one really big thing. I also think that I do a ton of other like foiling disciplines. I don't just kite, but I also, I do a lot of wing foiling now. I try to do a lot of surf foiling and I try to just get on a foil in any way possible. So I think I'm a very versatile athlete in that way. So I think that all of those foiling disciplines, it's like, yeah, although, I'm just going for a fun surf session, I think it also still really helps my kiting. And for example, I go to school in Hawaii, which is obviously sounds super fun, but I do go to class, I promise. But I also picked up tow foiling, and riding down a wave without actually a kite to hold on to and to stabilize you, it's really good cross training because you're really just relying on your own kind of body weight and your own balance to be, going that fast down a wave. You can go up to like 30 miles per hour down some of the bigger waves. So, yeah, I think just the one is the boat speed, just being faster. And then part of it is also feel and finesse and just having really good feel for how a kite should fly and how a foil should feel. And then also being quite versatile and doing all these other foiling disciplines and trying to do as many different types of foiling as possible, just to give me that extra experience and learn a little bit more.
Augustine, thank you very much for that question. It was a very good one, and it's led to some really interesting responses there from Daniela. Do you have any follow-ups, Augustine?
No, thank you so much, Danielle, for that great answer and guidance. And yeah, I also want to take this opportunity to thank Andy and everybody who runs this session. They're fantastic.
Well, that is wonderful to hear, and great to see you enjoying the sunshine. Where are you, by the way?
I'm in Halifax, Nova Scotia, right now in Canada.
amazing, where the 49er and Natural Worlds are going to be taking place later on this year. So pleased to see that the weather has come in for Canada and maybe see you there later on this year.
Yeah, we're looking forward to welcome everybody.
Thank you very much. Now, I'm going to just I'm going to pick up on the other questions in a moment, but Ryosuke has got a question to which I know most of the audience are hoping there's going to be an answer one way and not the other. But Ryosuke, do you want to come in and ask your question if you're able to? You've got 11 years of experience of sailing, I see. So let's see if we can get you in for that. Hi, Ryosuke. Can you hear me? Maybe not. So I'm going to read it out for him anyway. So
Hi.
Oh, yeah, we got you.
Oh, sorry. The room was busy. I'm Rio from Japan. I'm 23 years old. I have a sorry for my English. I have a 11 years of sailing experience, like 7 years dinghy and 4 years windsurfing. And then I went to Worlds a couple of times. And so do you think that I'll be able to compete like world championship, like whatever, as an athlete from my age?
Ryosuke, thank you very much for that, and really appreciate you coming in to ask that question. But now I'm age 53, I'm waiting to hear what the answer is going to be, Daniela.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think one of the beauties of kiting is that it is super accessible and anyone can pick it up. I mean, even my dad is, I think, over 16, or is he 60 now? I don't know how old. I think he's 60. And he's kite foiling and such a shredder. So I do think that it's a sport that is really for any age, because it is quite easy on your body in a lot of ways. Now, actually getting competitive in it, I think that's another story, because the more competitive it gets, the harder it is, for sure. And the more you have to be just really on top of things mentally and physically, and especially just with how fast everything is happening, you need to have a really quick reaction time to, you know, be able to be competitive. So I think that's one thing to think about for sure. And then the learning to tack and jive is pretty tricky and can be pretty scary too. So I think it definitely takes a little bit of a daredevil in you, but if you're willing to do that and you want that little bit of extra adrenaline and speed in your life, then Formula Kite is definitely for you.
Right. Well, I hope you do give it a go, Ryosuke. I still want to give it a go, and I've got a few years on you. So I'm glad that you answered the question that way, Daniela. Now, we've really got the questions pouring in, but I'm going to go further back up to the top to those who asked it earlier. And Greg, I saw that you managed to reappear. So Greg Rice, if you can come in and ask your question, let's see if we can get it this time. And come on, Greg. I know I saw you for a moment. But anyway, I'm interested to hear the answer to this one, if I can just get back and find where it was, and in some way back up the top again. Greg asks, now that kite foiling is part of the Olympic scene and hence the level of the campaigns rising, he'd be interested in knowing what technology you or the fleet are using or thinking about using to help assess performance on the water in training and competition. So Daniela, what, if any, technology do you use for analysis?
Yeah, so I track every single session on just a Garmin GPS watch. And then I have a coach that helps me analyze my tracks. So whether that's looking at VMG for different kite sizes and different conditions, or whether it's looking at maneuver losses, I think that part is huge. And I don't think that those numbers have really been figured out for kites yet. I'm also, whenever I have a coach and I'm training, we use a drone, because most rivs just can't keep up with us if there's any type of waves. Those are two big things, is like just the GPS watch and a drone. But I definitely see some other kind of things popping up in the future. I use a Sailmon also on my board, so I'm looking at the pitch and the roll and all those numbers as well.
Well, Greg will be greatly pleased to hear that you're using a Sailmon Max, because he bought one himself off the back of the Q&A that we did with Carlo Costa end of last year. And I see Mirko Babini, that's the president of the IKA. You're in on this call. Great to see you, Mirko. And I understand we're going to be seeing more Sailmons being used for social purposes as well, for sort of commentary and entertainment purposes, as well as the analysis. Gavin's got a question that is a good follow-on from that one, about maneuver loss. So Gavin, if you're here, let's get you in to ask about that. And this is obviously always an interesting question in the world of foiling and of high speed, where your straight line speed is so high that how often can you afford to tack? So let's see if you can get you in, Gavin.
Yeah, hi, can you hear me?
Yes, and what, just tell us, Gavin, what are you sailing? What's your interest here?
I sail lots of Wasp lately. And yeah, mostly Wasp right now.
Right.
So it's like the whole thing's kind of been like, how can you get your maneuvers like as good as possible? Because with maneuvers being pretty costly in foiling boats, I was wondering, how do you balance playing the course and the fleet while also minimizing your maneuvers?
Yeah, great question. So basically, the way I kind of think of it is, I like to think of type of day based on the conditions. So there's days when shifts matter, there's days when pressure matters, there are days when shifts and pressure matters, and then there's just random days where you might just not know what matters. And that was one really big thing I was actually working on in Palma, was like identifying the type of day and creating a strategy based on that day. And so I think on the shift matters days, that's when those are the types of days where adding those extra tacks might actually be helpful. And so what you want to be thinking about is, it's basically a question of, if I continue in this shift, is that going to, just put me at a loss, or is it better to tack here? So it is a super difficult question to answer, and I think a lot of it is also like how many shifts you're going through in one beat. So in one upwind, how many times is the wind actually shifting? And if it's shifting more than 4 to 6 times, then you definitely want to be tacking, because you're just going through so many lulls. It's a, obviously I can't put a like perfect answer on that. But I think also a lot of it just comes from experience and figuring out like what exactly, like what the, maybe not necessarily specific numbers, but you can kind of feel in the boat or in my kite what, how much the angle might decrease or increase based on the shift you're getting. And then from that, you kind of determine, okay, if I only have 30% of the leg left in the, in that upwind, then maybe it's just better to keep going, because I want to be closer to the top mark and I don't want to be calling the starboard lay line from super far. So that's kind of the way I've been thinking about it. But obviously, I'm still learning a ton, and kiting is very new, so it's all changing and there's still a lot to learn, and you always just have to be adapting.
Gavin, any follow-up questions on that? Anything else you'd like to know from Daniela?
No, that was pretty good explaining our process.
Great. All right. Well, thank you for that. And Dominic, you've got a good question that's related to this. So I'm going to see if you've got any further questions on this, Dominic, about judging wind shifts and how you, I mean, when you've got so many things, Daniela, that are free floating, unlike when you're sort of locked into a boat, and you can feel the whole boat beneath your body, there's nothing is fixed in foiling. So getting that lock on, whether that shift is real or not, to those of us that haven't kitefoiled, it seems like it must be some kind of dark art. But this is all the experience that you've had, I suppose, is it?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes from experience, but some of it is also just knowing your gear. And so at least in the Formula Kite class, there's like 2 to 3 different brands of kites and foils, and you start to kind of understand which ones go better upwind and downwind, and you start to kind of understand the gear that you're riding. So I know if I get a certain shift in my kite, then I know I can just hang on a little bit longer, or if I'm on a slightly bigger kite than the rest of the fleet, then I know then I can play that, and I know downwind, for example, I'll be pointing a little bit lower, so I can just play the game downwind a little bit more. So it just, yeah, I think a lot of it just comes from experience and understanding your gear, really, and just understanding how it works in different conditions.
Just talk us through the Formula Kite gear. Tell us what equipment, what brand you use, and what the different sizes of kite you use, and when you choose which.
Yeah, so there's pretty much 3 kite brands and 2 main foil brands that people are riding. The main kite brands are Fly Surfer and Ozone. The main foil brands are Chubanga and Levitas. I'm riding the Fly Surfer kites and Levitas foils. And for each event, we can register 4 different kite sizes, and those sizes have to be within a certain range, essentially. So we get 1 extra large kite, which is, I think, 15 or bigger. And then we get 1 medium-sized kite, which is, I think, between 11 and 15. And then we get 1 that is between 9 and 11, and then 1 9 or smaller. So you kind of have to like pick the sizes that you want to be registering. And the sizes that I usually register in, that the majority of the fleet registers, are 9, 11, 15, and 21. And then you get to pick whichever kite you want to ride for the day, and you can come in and switch kites in between races if the wind is changing a lot. So we do have quite a bit of flexibility there.
Now, I heard that when most of the women's fleet were going out on an 11 meter last week in Palma, you were choosing 15, which I was quite surprised to hear, because you're probably one of the smaller riders in terms of weight and stature. Would that be fair to say? But if that is the case, how do you manage to justify 15 when other people are using an 11?
Yeah, so I would say I'm pretty average size, honestly, for the women's fleet. And it's basically, so with the 2 different kite brands, the Fly Surfer is a little bit less powerful. So a lot of the times I am on a slightly bigger kite than the rest of the fleet. And a lot of times if let's say the Ozones are on 11 meter kites, then I would be on a 15. On that particular day in Palma, it was definitely on the edge. And I was even on the beach before going out to race. I was really debating between taking my 11 and 15, and I had both kites rolled out on the beach, and I was taking a very long time to decide which kite to use. But my rule of thumb is just to go on the same size kite as the guys, because I train with the guys, and I know that when the guys are on 15s, then I know that I can be on a 15. So that was what kind of led me to that decision. And I was pretty nervous in that decision, because I just wasn't feeling at 100%, and I had a really rough first couple of days of the regatta, so I was definitely a little bit shaken on confidence. But I was like, you know what, I'm just going to try the 15 and see how it goes. And I definitely surprised myself a little bit, because I usually ride the 15 when it's gusting up to like 18 or 19 knots. And I think that day we were getting a couple puffs up to 21, 22, at least on the top of the course. I was definitely, yeah, I was a little bit nervous, and the waves were pretty big. So, and it's harder to ride a bigger kite, and it's harder to be really powered in waves. So, yeah, I was definitely a little bit nervous, but it was also, you know, it was cool to learn that I can actually hold a bigger kite in that much wind. And strategically, it was also definitely the right decision, because as long as I could just hang on the upwind, usually smaller kites go better upwind because you can just point better. There's less drag. But I'm a really strong upwind rider. My upwind has always been a big strength for me, and downwind I've always struggled a little bit. So as long as I was able to hold on the upwind, then I was just, you know, I was gone on the downwind because I was just on a bigger kite than everybody else. So it was a fun day for sure.
I get the impression, you can correct me if this is wrong, but the fly surfers, because they're flatter, they tend to give you the edge on the upwind, and the ozone, you have to hang on a little bit more upwind, but they're a bit more spinnaker-ish downwind so that they give you the edge to go faster and deeper downwind. Is that a good comparison? And if so, why did you choose to go with what you've done?
Yeah, exactly. So the fly surfer is just, it's higher aspect, so it does go better upwind, but not as well downwind. And the ozone, they're honestly like pretty polar opposites. The ozone is much lower aspect, so it doesn't go as well upwind. It also has three rows of bridle instead of just two. So it does have a little bit of extra drag. So upwind, it doesn't do as well, but downwind, it's definitely just points a little bit better. So it's kind of, yeah, it's a give or take, but I really like the fly surfer because I think the range is much bigger than on the ozone. So, for example, my range on my 15-meter kite is, let's say, between 14 knots and now 21 knots, we'll say, whereas on the ozone, I would probably be riding the ozone in about only 14 to 18 knots maybe. So it's the fly surfer gives me a much bigger range. I also think that it's I really like feel and I like finesse. So I think a lot of the guys, for example, they really try to muscle everything and they don't feel the kite as much. But with the fly surfer, I can feel every little bit of pressure and just take advantage of it better. Whereas on the ozone, you just don't have the same feel. So I think that's actually something pretty interesting with the kite fleet, is that you have to figure out which kite and which foil kind of complement your riding style and what you like in terms of feel. And that's kind of what makes you go the fastest.
I remember when I was doing the commentary for the kite foiling in the Canaries at the end of last year, you weren't there, but Lauriane Nolot, who was leading most of last week in Palma, ended that season feeling disappointed with her kit. And she said she was going to change her kit over the winter and she was going to reassess things. Whatever she did, based on what we saw in Palma, seemed to be working for her. But my question is, when do you know when to blame the kit? And when do you know to look at yourself, to ask yourself the question that it, maybe you're the problem rather than the kid?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I'm still trying to figure that out. but I think that, I don't know, I feel very confident in my gear. And I know that it's been, it comes from the factory pretty well. And I know that if I put a few... Once I put a few sessions on it, then it's going to be stretched in and I'm very confident in it. And so I think that, and I'm also, at the same time, I'm also very confident in myself and I know how a fast kite should feel. And I know when a kite starts feeling unstable because it's been stretched one way too much, or it starts flying to one side, or just something has happened with the bridles. So I think it's a balance of just understanding the gear again, but also understanding and having confidence in yourself and feeling when a kite just isn't working. I've also been very lucky that I've had really good training partners in the past and I've been able to line up with people. And I know that if I go on one kite one day and I'm doing really well, and then later that afternoon I'm not doing well on a different kite, it's very likely the kite and not me. So it's definitely just a balance and it's a combination of understanding yourself while also understanding your gear.
Okay. Knowing when your kit is wearing out and when it's getting beyond race ability, I'm going to get Hamish in to answer this question as well. Hi, Hamish. I know you're desperate to drag the conversation over to wing foiling. So we'll maybe get Daniela to talk about her expertise there. But maybe Daniela and you, Hamish, let's start with you, Hamish. Is it okay to train in boats and or on boards with slightly older gear, with sails that are slightly knackered, or is that a distraction from good training?
Yeah, I don't know. If my opinion would be if when you're getting into it and you're starting up and you're still learning a whole lot of stuff, it doesn't matter. But when you've gotten great, like Daniela is, you know, it matters a lot. So I think that would probably be the rough answer. Just, you know, if you're just kicking off your campaign and you've never done it before and you're really just looking for hours, you just grab anything and get out there and you're learning in so many different areas. And the bad habits you might get into with poor gear will just be a bit, you know, fogged up with everything else. But if you're, you know, if you're really, really good, then yeah, bad gear can push you down the road of bad habits.
And Daniela, what about you? Now that you've got this sense of when a kite is getting old, is it okay to go training on that kite or not?
I think that there's like certain times it is, and there's certain times it isn't. So let's say you do have an old kite that is just stretched out, let's say, but it's not front stalling and it's still stable in really gusty conditions. I think that's totally fine. But I think it's once you start losing time on the water or just losing time in your session, that's when it becomes something negative, because you don't want to be losing hours on the water because something's not working properly. So I think maybe my kite feels a little bit slow because I've been using it for a year now and it's just old. I don't really see a problem in that. I'm still going to keep training on that and using it. But it's like if it starts front stalling and if I start swimming more than I'm actually foiling, then that to me is when it becomes a problem, and that's when you want to swap it out.
Great. Dominic, I did try to address your question earlier. I'm not sure what happened to that. But if you're around now and you want to come in and ask that question, let's address that now. We have dealt with this a little bit, but let's see if there's more that we can address here.
Yeah. Hi, Daniela. Can you hear me? I used to race sailboats quite a lot, and now I'm a windsurfer. So I depended on a compass a lot, and now not so much anymore. My question is, how do you judge wind shifts while kiting? Do you use a compass? And if, how? Can you see it, or where is it? Is it glasses? Where do you see the numbers? Or do you just judge the angles to the waves, or you're just watching the fleet? And how the wind shifts or wind bends deal with the.
Yeah, so I usually pretty much up until very recently, I've always just gone off of where I'm pointing relative to the fleet or relative to land or to some other mark. Once I got a Sailmon last year, so that has definitely been helpful. And I use that in my sessions now when I'm training. Obviously we can't have GPS devices when we're racing, so I don't use it when I'm racing. I go back to just, you know, land or the fleet. But yeah, I think it just comes down to that experience.
Great. Well, Dominic, I hope
so no compass.
No compass.
Dominic, thank you very much for that question. We'll see if compasses start to come into the equation further down the track. It's still a new sport, isn't it, Daniela? But I know Hamish and you need to have a conversation about wing foiling. So how much wing foiling have you done? And you talked about the variety of foiling that you do and how everything feeds into everything else. What does wing foiling for you bring to the package?
Yeah, so I started winging in 2020, actually, kind of during COVID because I was pretty burnt out from kiting and there weren't any events happening. So I wanted to just try something different that still got me on the water and kept me foiling, but wasn't necessarily kiting. And I think I love winging for just how simple it is. And I like being able to. I really like pumping in waves and I really like winging in waves. So any chance I can get just to do a downwinder, I love doing that. I think it's really good practice for pumping, actually, which is coming into play more and more when we're racing. And when I say pumping, I mean like the pumping your legs on the foil to keep it foiling. So a lot of times when it's really light, we're actually pumping out of tacks because if you just put your kite down, it's not enough momentum to stay foiling. So that's been really helpful, and I think it's just a different type of foiling because you're using different gear and you have to adapt your how you ride and where you put your like where you put your feet on the board. So I think it's a different way of learning, and it's just a it's just good like foil control, and it's a good way to practice your foiling that isn't necessarily going 30 knots all the time, you know?
And Hamish, Pete Bowling and Blair Chute, they are very versatile athletes as well. They do all kinds of foiling. Tell me what that's brought to them, and also what it's brought to your own experience.
Yeah, well, it's interesting with the cup boats, you know, foiling these new ones in particular, monohulls. It's quite a lot like wing foiling, or and I noticed all the skippers and a lot of the crew got into winging just to really simulate that feeling of how the boat, you know, how the board gets up onto the foil, and you know, you're feeling it through your feet, you're feeling it everywhere really, and it certainly helps. There's no doubt about it, and I think it's probably the purest sense of foiling, because you've got no controls, like a moth. You know, you really do have to, as Daniel said, you're going to have to kind of pump you've got to learn to coordinate the whole sail pump and leg pump thing to get up on the foil. So yeah, it's really, really interesting, and I think it's helped a lot with the cup world. All the skippers are doing it.
And Daniela, while we're on that subject, what have you learned from sailing with Jimmy Spithill and Sail GP?
Yeah, Sail GP has been incredible. I think that one of the big things for me was just how, even though it is such a different platform and it is so different from kiting in a lot of ways, there's still so many similarities because, like Hamish just said, like it's still foiling and all of the concepts are the same, but you're just applying them to a different platform. So, for me at the beginning, I was super intimidated, honestly, at first because I felt like I really didn't know that much about multi-hulls and I didn't know much about sailing to begin with. Like I'd done a bit of sailing, obviously, but I just wasn't that experienced. But then I realized like the more and more time I spent in it, the more I was learning about it, I was like, oh, we're doing all the same things that I do in kiting, but it's just on a much bigger platform and we're pressing buttons instead of just like, you know, rolling your ankle a little bit. So, it's the same, but it's different. But I think just getting to work with Jimmy and that whole group has been so incredible. And Jimmy's such a leader, and he really leads by example. And he has this very powerful aura, and it's really cool to get to learn from them and just to be involved in that group.
Moko Babini is asking what ambitions you have to race in the America's Cup.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to do a cup. I think that, I mean, who doesn't, obviously? I think that we're in very interesting times right now with women in pro sailing. And I think that I honestly think that like pro sailing is still a boys' club. Like that's a fact. I think the America's Cup is still a boys' club, and this is just my personal opinion and how I see things right now, and I think how things are being portrayed, but it's very much still a boys' club. And to be honest, it's really hard for me to imagine being in an America's Cup because I simply just haven't seen any other women in it. And it's same with CLGP. Like, it's really hard for me to imagine myself being in that position because there's no one like me doing it, you know? So it's a pretty tough position to be in. And I think we're definitely on the brink of, you know, some proper change, I think, and that there's a lot of progress being made in that. But I think that the culture of pro sailing is still very male dominated, and being a young woman in that can be pretty intimidating. And I think that the culture just still has a long way to go. And unless the men actually, and unless the leaders and the role models in the sport try to change, then I frankly just don't see there being any real change. And I just don't see the culture changing because, you know, those are the guys that everybody else looks up to. And those are the guys that are kind of defining the culture. And because it is a culture, I understand that it's not going to change overnight. But I think that there's progress being made, but we still have a long way to go.
Well, a very interesting statement that you've made there, and it makes me think of what the former 470 and 49er sailor from Italy, Giulio Conti, was saying to me last week. I'm not going to open this can of worms too much with 8 minutes to go, but she refers to what she calls pink washing. If you think of the other terms that we hear about, sports washing and green washing, she believes that there's an element of pink washing going on in sailing and some virtue signalling to get women involved without a real intent to do so. But that is a massive can of worms that maybe we'll come back to another time and do a Q&A on that. But thank you for your frank comments on that. It tells us we got a lot further to go. Let's dig back into the performance elements. Well, actually, Hamish, let's see if we can help Daniela out with a problem that she's got, because it reminds me of the problem that Pete and Blair had in the 49er. They were on this win streak where they were just winning after winning after winning. And earlier on in the call, we found out that Daniela's won about 25 international competitions on the trot, and she nearly lost one last week in Parma, but she still won it. What's your advice to Daniela? How's she going to deal with this loss if it ever happens?
That's a really good question, but I kind of think we never went after this winning streak. You know, it just happened by default. I think the boys decided, you know, they wanted to, as a team, we sort of decided we wanted to give ourselves the chance at each regatta. So in other words, you know, you don't put so much risk in terms of, okay, this regatta is all about learning to start, or this regatta is all about, I'm going to try something really new with technique or equipment. It was always, let's do that sort of stuff in our training and make sure that when we went into an event there, we had enough in our package to be able to win. So, you know, giving yourself the chance to win was a philosophy we started with from the beginning. And that makes, you know, a big difference to your attitude, because you don't just rock up, you know, the day before, you know, you get to the start line with enough time, and, you know, you do all the things, all the processes have to be right to enable yourself to win. So I think that's really the key to it in the end, is that, you know, it was never about winning. It was really about the processes that enabled the winning and getting them right, and just keep fine-tuning the processes to enable the winning.
Well, Daniela, that's probably music to your ears. It's not dissimilar to what you talked about with processes earlier. So when you are setting the benchmark and setting the standard, how do you keep on improving when there isn't a target on somebody else's back to aim at?
Yeah, I mean, definitely preaching to the choir here. I've been really focused on a process-oriented mindset, especially over the past year. And I think that it's not only about just embracing the process, but I think it's also about creating an environment for yourself that you can actually succeed in and that you can actually deliver in. So a lot of it comes from just surrounding yourself with the right people and having the right team around you, and really doing everything you can to just to, yeah, to be in a place and a mindset where you can actually perform the best you can. And so something that has just always fueled me is just, you know, I get to kite all over the world every single day, which is incredible. And I love my sport and I love what I'm doing and I love trying to get faster and I love pushing myself and I love breaking boundaries and seeing what I can do and how far I can push myself. And I love learning about kiting and I love learning about my foil and how to make my kite go faster, how to make my foil go faster. So I'm definitely very much a student of the game and I try to learn as much as I can every single day. And I'm really working on creating a process and environment for myself where I can keep getting better every single day. And yes, obviously winning is a cherry on top of that, but I'm doing something that I love right now. And yeah, I want to try to keep winning, but I also just want to keep getting better and keep improving and just try to become the best athlete and person I can be.
Greg asked a question some way back, but it's relevant to what we're talking about. So Greg Rice said, in terms of the recent regatta in Parma, where you were behind going into the last day, what was the reason you found yourself in unfamiliar territory? What errors did you make?
Yeah, I think that it just came down to preparation. So like I mentioned earlier, I've been, I'm still in school right now. I'm going to be graduating university in May. So this past winter, I had to go back to in-person classes for the first time in 2 years. So basically since COVID, I've just been online. So I had to go back to being in person in January. And so that definitely took a lot of time from my training when normally I would have spent a lot more time in Mexico or wherever it is, just getting on the water every day. So basically just coming into Palma, I had 1 week of training a few weeks before actually flying to Palma. And then I had the CLGP event in San Francisco. And then after San Francisco, I flew to Hawaii on Monday and I was there for 48 hours to take a couple midterm exams for school. And then I flew back to San Francisco Wednesday night, landed Thursday morning, repacked my board bags, and then flew to Palma Thursday afternoon. Along the way, I also got sick because obviously I was tired and stressed and all of the above. So when I landed in Palma, I wasn't ready to perform at my best, which honestly, I accepted and I was okay with that because, you know, I got to do these other things and I have these other things that I'm trying to do. In the future, I won't be sacrificing my campaign for these other things. But I think that it was a sacrifice that I didn't mind making at that point. And now going forward, obviously I've learned from it and I know that I'm definitely going to be, you know, showing up to regattas way earlier, like I usually do. But yeah, I think the first couple of days, I just wasn't ready to perform my best and I was still sick. And it was just a combination of a lot of things.
KKL has asked an interesting question. I think I'm going to ask this on your behalf, KKL. Sorry, we're running out of time, but this again is quite similar to what you're already talking about, Daniela. But in your ideal training schedule, how do you structure your training for the 3 weeks leading into an event? So when you're casting aside all those other bright, shiny distractions, what is the perfect build up to a major event?
Yeah, so I guess once I finish school in May, I'm going to be full-time kiting. So I definitely envision a very different kind of periodization. And I want to show up to a regatta, at least to the venue, at least 1 week before racing begins. And depending on the venue, maybe it's even longer, maybe it's shorter. And then the week prior to that, I'm just getting a bunch of time in with a coach. It could be a different kind of coach based on what I need to be focusing on at that time. But, I think that I have a lot to learn here. I've never done an Olympic campaign before, so I'm very much just, still figuring things out. And I think like I said before, the big thing for me is just going to be surrounding myself with the right people, and people that have my best interest in mind that want to help me. So if I can have those, you know, those coaches and those people helping me in the leading up to whatever regatta it is, then I think that's going to be really good.
Well, we're just about on time here. Hamish, I know that you're a big fan of small craft. You've been involved with America's Cup campaigns, but I'm trying to remember what that formula is that you say in Road to Gold and how exactly you put it. But you know what I'm talking about. The smaller the craft, the more important the athletes feel for the craft. But you put it a lot more eloquently than that. You know what I'm talking about. What do you think about these kite foilers and the fact that they've got so little to work with and they go so fast?
Yeah, there's no doubt they're the best. You know, the formula I was referring to is that, you know, in the Olympic classes, we had this big range of equipment from board sailors to starboard sailors. And I was rationale that, you know, I've seen people win starboard gold medals in 6 months of sailing a starboard, and you can never ever see that on a windsurfer, and it's even less likely again on a kite. So the bigger the lighter the equipment ratio towards the human body, the more hours you have to spend in perfecting it, because, you know, as Daniela said, you know, slightly adjusting your foot position, a few millimeters, or just even putting some more load on the heel compared to the toe or the side of the foot, is going to make the difference between passing somebody and going faster or not. And so it really, really rewards time on the water and, young, you know, really, really agile agility and just, you know, quick reflexes. So, for me, I'm super excited about it. Anything to do with lightweight equipment and speed. And I think, Danielle, you're going to go great with your Olympic campaign. I think, you've got to be, make sure you stay in control of it. It's great to get, other people around and advice, as you say, from the best. But make sure you stay in control and create your own environment, and you'll have a wonderful Olympic campaign. It's been awesome listening to you.
It certainly has. And Daniela, it is staggering to think what you've achieved at the age of 21 and how you have such a level of humility and grace about what you do and the way that you go about it. And so it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on this call for the last 60 minutes. I can't wait to see more of you on the Olympic circuit. And if you've never seen the kite foiling before, I encourage you to get along to a beach somewhere and see it, because one of the things that stood out to me last week in Princess Sophia was the number of passers-by that weren't passing by. They were stopping with their mouths wide open to watch you guys launching and foiling off the beach. So it's definitely got spectator appeal to people that don't understand our sport. And if there's one reason why the kite foiling should be in the Olympics, amongst the many other reasons, it's right there. It really does capture people's imagination, doesn't it, Daniela?
Yeah, I would say so. I think it's pretty exciting to watch, but obviously I'm biased.
But you do what you do because you love it, and that comes through. So thank you so much for that. Thank you for some really great questions. We had some really good questions coming through the chat box. I didn't get round to all of them, so my apologies for that. And I'm sure Greg Rice speaks for many with his text at the end of the chat box. So, Daniela, enjoy your brief time off in Marseille. Recharge those batteries, and we'll be watching out for big things at the Air Olympic Regatta coming up very soon. And for the rest of 2022, look forward to seeing you somewhere on the circuit. And I look forward to seeing all of you on this call, on our call next week, when we are going to one of the legends of the laser class. But I'm not going to tell you who yet. But we're going to go back to sitting out boats next week. Thanks very much, Hamish. Thanks, Daniela. Thanks to everyone on this call. That's it from us from Road to Gold. See you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Cheers. Thank you.